Welcome to Linux Matters, a podcast featuring three experienced open source professionals as we discuss the impact Linux has on our daily lives. This is episode 37 and I'm Alan. And this week, I've been making yet more snaps and things have changed.
Hello, I'm Martin and I have been hacking the best font that was ever created.
Hi, I'm Mark and I've been streaming music to myself.
You may have heard of this packaging format called Snap. There are a number of snaps with my name on, and there's two more now. At work, we have a couple of command line utilities. One is called Sift, S-Y-F-T, and the other one is called Gripe, G-R-Y-P-E.
Oh, I've heard about them somewhere. I think I heard about them on a podcast called Linux Matters.
I may have mentioned them. Anyway, they're both open source, Apache 2 license, I think, and they have various ways to install them on different platforms. Yeah, there's a curl pipe to bash jobby. There's Debs, there's Tarballs and all that kind of stuff. And I find myself sometimes not having the latest version installed because it doesn't auto-update. And you have to like rerun the curl pipe to bash thing or go and get a Deb or something. And that kind of annoys me because I live in the world of now and up-to-date software and I run Ubuntu LTS. So I thought, what if I make a snap? And I made a prototype and just tried it out, and sure enough, they work. You know, I can install them locally and the applications work, but I thought it'd be nice if we could share the love and let other people install the software via Snap. And I know there's some people who don't like it and, you know, it's fat and bloated and all that kind of stuff, but for this kind of thing, it's perfect for a single binary inside a package that's automatically updated. And we do updates like every few weeks, sometimes more often. And so it's nice to be up to date because Gripe is a vulnerability scanner. And so having the latest smarts to be able to detect vulnerabilities is a good thing. So I made these two snaps, but they both require quite broad access across your system. And there's a concept with snaps called classic snaps, which is unconfined. So I had to make them unconfined because users who are using Sift and Gripe can just scan any arbitrary directory. And Sift will generate an SBOM, a list of all the things that are in that directory, be it Debs or Ruby gems or NPM packages or PyPy stuff. And it can't do that if it can't access the directory. And so I had to make it classic. And the same for Gripe, because it does the same kind of thing, but it generates a list of vulnerabilities for software that's in that directory. And I've made a bunch of classic snaps before, and it's not really been a problem. But the way you do it now, Canonical have put a few more checks and balances in. And I was kind of surprised, pleasantly, at the process. Yeah, don't you know who I am? Why won't you let me have classic?
Are these additional checks and balances in response to the recent crypto miner sort of explosion that happened?
I don't know if it's directly as a result of that. I think they have tightened things up a little bit on a bunch of policies around registering snaps. And like if you register a snap, it used to be that you can just go Snapcraft, register, and then the name of a thing. And if nobody else had it, bam, you've got it. There were some exceptions, like some of the common words were already taken. They were pre-registered and common package names in Linux repositories were pre-taken. But now that's changed. And when you run Snapcraft register and then the name of your snap, it punts you to a web page where you have to fill in a form and explain. And that road bump, I think, is probably the biggest blocker to getting the crypto nonsense out of the store, because you have to, you can't just register a name and you can't automate it either. You have to actually fill in the form and you have to wait. And there's some delay of, you know, days before you get your snap name. Now, I wasn't in a hurry, so that was fine.
Yeah, we spoke about StreamSprout last episode, and I registered the StreamSprout name to publish a snap. And in that process of filling in a form, you have to provide a justification as to why you are qualified or allowed, if you like, to register that name.
Yeah.
I think it took a day, half a day or something, for somebody to respond to that.
So I've been using a snap which I assumed would need classic confinement, but actually doesn't, which is the Docker snap. And the reason that that doesn't use classic confinement is because it's limited to only being able to run against files that are in your home directory. So I would have thought that maybe with Sift and Gripe, you would be running it against software you're developing, and that would be stuff that's in your home directory, and that might be enough. But is that not actually how people use it generally?
So two things. One, the Docker thing, there are certain applications that have special interfaces created just for them.
Right.
And Docker is one of them. So it would have been the case back in the day that the Docker snap probably would have had to have been classic,
mm-hmm.
but they put the effort in to create a special interface called Docker.
Right.
And only the Docker snap can use the Docker interface because it is quite broad
mm-hmm.
and it does allow more access. So when there are applications like that, and like Steam, Steam has a special set of interfaces that gives it more access than most games, for example. So they do a bit of engineering to make sure that the interfaces are bespoke to the thing that needs a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Sift and Gripe are partly developer tools,
yeah,
but they can also be used anywhere along the tool chain. So not just on your developer workstation. They could be used anywhere in CI, for example, literally anywhere.
Yeah.
And so you can't know where an end user is going to run it and going to point it.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And that's why I went for classic. So the conversation starts on a thread on the forum, and I fill in as much detail as I possibly can. And there's a back and forth, and there was a little oopsie in that I got given classic confinement. And first, I only requested it for Sift first. I only did one of them at a time because I thought I don't want to confuse people by doing two at the same time that are related applications. So I just did one and I got it granted, and they hadn't quite gone through the whole process of vetting. And this isn't a thing that's relatively new. They've added a step where someone from Canonical sends you a token inside the Snap Store. So I've already registered the name. They then send me a little token, just like 10 characters, and I have to commit that to the upstream repo to prove that I have access to the Sift repo, to prove that I work for Anchor and I have access to the repository. I don't have to land the PR. I don't have to put it anywhere in the code or anything. I just have to prove that I can create a commit against the upstream project. So I did that, and then they turned that around, and they gave me classic access. The oopsie was they gave it to me a little bit early without doing that vetting. But I'm a good boy, and I didn't publish my software until I'd gone through the proper vetting. But once I had, I then created another post and said, hey, deja vu, here comes another one. It's almost exactly the same reasons. I still work for the same company. It's just a second snap. And so I got them both vetted as classic and published in the store.
And having gone through this process now, is there anything in the Snap Store that shows that you have been through this and they've done something to prove that you are a genuine developer of the upstream project?
No, there's actually nothing that tells you that I am an authoritative person. So two snaps side by side, it wouldn't show. I think that is a good thing that should be there, that shows that vetting has been done. And I guess if anyone did some investigation if someone outside is trying to figure out who has these permissions and who doesn't, they could look into it. And so you could figure that out. The only other thing I wanted to mention is I've tried to automate as much as possible. So I've added GitHub Actions that will check the upstream repo. So when the open source team publish a new version of Sift and Gripe, my GitHub Action will just nudge the version number and then build a new version and push it to the store. And then I can test it and publish it to a stable channel. And it's pretty automated. There's not an awful lot I have to do. I also rationalize down the Snapcraft config. So I literally just yoink the binary out of GitHub from the upstream repo and just put that in the snap. And literally the snap contains almost nothing but the binary and a little bit of metadata, the description, and that's it. That's all that's in there. So it's nice and lean and tidy, and it gets updated whenever the upstream developers publish a new version. And I know when that is because they have a little bot that announces it on our company Slack. So I know when there's a new release. And I can force my little action to run if I want to, or I can make it more often. But yeah, it works. It's pretty good.
I think that there's a really important point there that you kind of skipped over, which is that auto-updating capability, because Sift and Gripe are, security tools. You always want the current version, and there's no way to stay automatically up to date with Sift and Gripe unless you use the snap on Linux. Am I right in saying that?
I guess it depends. Like, some people are using these tools in automation anyway.
Right.
And so they're always pulling, when their job runs, the very first thing is it pulls the latest version. So they'll always be up to date, I guess.
Right.
I guess it depends. If you're a developer. So this is why it doesn't affect the guys who work on the tool, because they're always running like the bleeding edge version of it. It only affects muggins here. I'm the one who has the problem because I don't constantly run the latest version of either of those tools, but now I can because I'm just using the Snap.
Mm-hmm.
I think from my point of view, I've always been a bit of a fan of Snaps, and I've always been a bit of a fan of packaging single binaries as Snaps, because especially when it's auto updating and, you know, you get the latest and you don't have to worry about it and it just does it in the background. I love it. So yeah, there you go. My little story for yet more Snaps for the good old Snapcraft ecosystem.
I have taken the best font that was ever created and made it nerd font compatible.
I know everyone is now shouting some comedic font, whether it's Comic Sans.
Papyrus.
Yes, or Courier New or Arial. What is it then?
The best font ever created was originally called Fixed Sys, and it was the monospace font that was the font on Windows 1 and Windows 2. And it was subsequently renamed to System in Windows 3.
I think I can kind of picture it.
Yeah.
Monospace, slightly blocky on some of the letters.
Yes, it was an 8x6 font. And what was so good about it is that it was that classic sort of VGA font, but a little soft around the edges and a little more stylized. And most importantly, had a full complement of code page 437 glyphs. So it did everything.
It had both happy face and inverted happy face.
It did. And it
all
had
of the glyphs.
Three shaded blocks.
Wow.
Those were the days, you know, and both single line and double line box
and
drawing. And so this font was fantastic. And back in the days when I used things like 4DOS and 4OS2 and 4NT, this was the font you wanted because it did everything. And going into my Linux era, a new project was created called Fixed Sys Excelsior, which was a recreation of the Fixed Sys font, but as TTF and OTF compatible, so you could put it on modern operating systems. And that was the font that I used on my UltraSpark workstation running RHEL 5 back in the day in order to give me that, you know, proper pucker console experience. And I used Fixed Sys Excelsior font for many years until it was no longer serviceable. And the problem was, is that it didn't have all of the new glyphs that we now see in modern fonts, particularly those fonts that are maintained by the nerd font community. And if you're not familiar with what nerd font is, nerd font is a collection of, I don't know how many fonts, but I would say maybe 100 or so monospace fonts, which have been patched to include thousands of additional glyphs. So I think it uses the Libre Awesome font and things like the Powerline glyphs and all sorts of stuff. So you can use tools like Powerline and Starship, which are console prompt superpowers to display all sorts of useful information. I use a thing called Powerline Go. So when I'm in a Git directory, I can see the status of my Git tree in the prompt. Or if I SSH into a machine, it puts a little bright orange telephone in my prompt and I can see which hosts I'm remotely logged into because there's a big telephone in the prompt.
When you say glyphs, I think people are probably not realizing, if you've never used Powerline, there's, you know, little things like there's a padlock in the line, and sometimes there's little arrows, like there's a colored section and then an arrow and then a colored section, or chevron.
Yeah.
And they kind of overlay on top of each other. And without the glyphs that you're talking about, it looks like jank.
Yeah.
And the wrong characters appear and it just looks awful.
It does.
And I think if you install Powerline and you don't do this, go and get the nerd fonts or a patched font. You probably think your Powerline install is broken.
Ah.
Indeed. Exactly so.
That might be why I never got along with Powerline.
That'll be exactly why you have to have nerd fonts. Even these days, just having Powerline patched fonts isn't sufficient, because the Powerline glyphs are only like 160 or so, and the nerd font patch set is like 8,000 additional glyphs.
There's like the little icon for when you fork something in a Git repo.
Right.
Yeah. It shows you the little fork icon in the Powerline.
Yep.
It's cute.
With little numbers showing you how far forward or behind, like, the master origin you are and things like that. It's terrific. So it's a productivity enhancement. And nerd fonts, you can get them all. And I used like the patched Ubuntu version of nerd fonts for many years. And I've been using the Fira code nerd font for a couple of years now. But Fixis, it keeps nagging at me. I keep on wanting to go back to it because it was just such a good font. And there are people that have continued to maintain Fixis Excelsior to this day and have added Powerline glyphs to it, but it doesn't have all that other stuff. And I thought, how hard can it be? The nerd font community make a tool called Nerd Font Patcher. So I thought, well, that should be a piece of cake. So there's a continuation of Fixis Excelsior on GitHub. There'll be a link in the show notes. And there is also a new project called Fixed Sys Core, which is a modern interpretation of Fixed Sys. So it doesn't have the hard pixelated edges of the font. It honors the original style, but it's all nice, smooth edges and, you know, curved corners and things.
Original style, you say, on an IBM 5150 monitor.
Right. It has the right look. But neither of these fonts have nerd fonts. So anyway, I installed Nerd Font Patcher and I ran it against these two fonts, and glory be, I had two nerd font patched fonts. And I thought, this is brilliant. Our Powerline worked and I thought my job was done. And then I started running tools like Bottom and Btop and Gping, which use Braille to draw pseudographics. And none of the Braille glyphs are included in Nerd Font Patcher. So I had a sad face and I went looking around and I saw that 4 years ago, somebody submitted a patch to Nerd Fonts to add Braille glyph patching to Nerd Font Patcher. That languished for a couple of years. And 2 years ago, somebody else dusted that patch up and resubmitted it. And it sat there for another 2 years.
Oh, my life.
And I was like, well, there's prior art here. So after 4 years, I'm now the third person to have a go at this. And I refactored this patch once more. And I worked on a local patch and then I added a conversation in the long running thread about adding Braille patching support to nerd fonts. And one of the nerd font contributors picked up what I have done and actually merged it into a branch of like future state work. So it isn't released yet, but it is there.
One step closer.
What language is nerd font patcher written in? Is this something you'd used before?
I think it was Python.
Right. Okay.
I think it was Python.
Nothing too esoteric then.
No. So the original patch from 4 years ago, it was like hundreds and hundreds of lines.
Hmm.
And when I was analyzing it, lots of the code that was in that original patch is now in Nerd Font Patcher.
Right.
But bits of the Braille support are not. So in the end, it only turned out to be a 13-line patch.
Nice.
But
nice.
I had to sort of do this sort of, you know, archaeology to figure out which bits needed adding.
So when you patch a font like Fixis, obviously the reason you like it is because of this particular style. Does it just take this same set of glyphs that it's adding to every font and stick them in that font and it always looks the same? Or does it do something that matches anything about the font you're adding it to?
No.
Right.
So the glyphs that it patches are a common set.
Right.
So the nerd font patches apply the same glyphs to every font, so they don't adhere to a style of the original patch.
So you don't have to do a lot of testing and make sure that what it's patched then works in this particular font. It's just the same thing. It's going to work.
Yeah, more or less. One of the things you can do is you can tell nerd fonts which glyphs you want to patch and which ones you want to overwrite regardless and which you don't. So for Fixis Excelsior, which is a pixelated font and had pixelated powerline glyphs, I've left those intact, but only added the additional glyphs that didn't already exist to fill in the gaps. But Fixis Core, which is a modern, sort of nicely shaped, high-resolution font, I just overlaid everything. Anyway, in doing this, I learned a whole load of things about Braille and how Braille is used to draw pseudo-graphics. But after creating this patch, I have now got my favourite font fully patched with nerd fonts and Braille, and I am now using it as my terminal font on my machine. And by the time you listen to this, there will be a GitHub repository where you too can download the glorious Fixis font and use it in your terminal as well.
And like me, you can install it and then go, what on earth is this? And then switch to something else that actually looks nice. I would love to hear from our listeners if they actually use this thing. It's hideous.
It's glorious.
One of the things on my home server, as I may have mentioned before, is my music library. So I am not a customer of any streaming services that the kids are into nowadays. I did for a time subscribe to Spotify, but because of reasons, I no longer do that. And I like to buy my music on CD and rip it and have it in a format that can't be disappeared as a result of music industry politics.
Yeah, that's a real thing. One of the reasons why I left Spotify and switched to Apple Music is the most recent Van Halen album just silently disappeared from Spotify because of publishing shenanigans.
Yes, I had an entire genre of music which I had recently discovered taken away from me. So I'm not letting that happen again. As a result of having all this music sitting on my server, I need a way to listen to it easily, and I don't really want to have to sync my entire library to every device that I have. So I need some kind of streaming solution, but that's self-hosted. And over the years, and my various incarnations of my home server setup, I've had a few things that I've tried, but I've never found anything that was really that good until now.
I'm really interested to hear what you're about to present, because I want to set up something similar on my home server.
Well, I'll start off with the things that haven't worked out in the past, tease you a bit into the big reveal. There was once, and possibly still is, a project called Ampatchy, which, as the name suggests, was, I think it was actually, the streaming was based on HTTP. It was basically a web server which served you your audio files. But I found it to be, it sort of worked a bit, but it was quite flaky and there were really a lack of clients. I think an old version of Amarok supported it. I think that's why I used it at the time. But then that support kind of went away as versions changed and so on. I used Envy for a time, which is now known as Jellyfin. Or no, it's not. It's now been forked as Jellyfin. I think Envy still exists, which is a whole home media server, and I was hosting my video on there, so I thought I'll host my audio on there as well. That was never particularly satisfactory because it's really rubbish at creating and managing playlists of audio. If you want to go through your library and pick out certain songs and put them into a big playlist, it's really difficult to do that with MB. I then migrated to Plex, which I found was a bit better, but has some limitations because it's more geared towards getting you to subscribe to their Plex passes, particularly if you want to use it on mobile. You're otherwise stuck with just listening in the web player, which, you know, mostly works. I used that for quite a while and it was okay. But now I've stopped using Plex for audio and I only use it for video because I have discovered Subsonic. So Subsonic is a streaming server, but it's also a protocol for an open source protocol for streaming music and hosting music, which means there's a bunch of third party clients and servers, as well as the Subsonic server you can find at subsonic.org. So when I was setting up my new home server, I went around looking at what options existed for running a Subsonic compatible server on Docker. And I found a nice lightweight solution called Navidrome.
Never heard of it.
Nope, nor had I. But I found it and I tried it, and it was really easy to set up, and it scanned my library. It gives you a nice, lightweight but functional web interface, and it does decent playlist management, which was an important thing for me.
So this isn't the Subsonic project. This is another project that implements the Subsonic protocol.
Yes.
Wonderful. Okay. Because I've used Subsonic in the past, and there was a similar community explosion as MB and Jellyfin because the licensing changed and right. It got forked as LibreSonic, and I used that for a while, but it kind of bit rotted and it wasn't well maintained. So
yes. That's
what I was looking for a replacement for. So this is interesting. I didn't know there were alternative implementations.
Yes, so there are actually quite a few out there. So I had to do quite a bit of a software sustainability assessment, shall we say, to work out, you know, which ones were the active projects and which ones were well packaged and maintained and so on. And Navidrome seemed like it was actually, you know, still an active project and worked well. And even if it doesn't work well, the Docker container that I've pulled should keep going and doesn't rely on anything else for now. So I've got that. And if I want to listen on desktop, I just fire up the web interface and that works nicely. But if I want to use it on my phone, I wanted a Subsonic client. And it also turns out there's a number of Subsonic compatible clients out there. And the one I have gone with is called Tempo.
Is that an Android only thing?
I think so.
Okay. You carry on talking and I'll let you know shortly.
Yeah, I'm not sure because the only phone I have is an Android phone. So I haven't looked for iOS apps, but there may be an iOS app called Tempo as well. But if not, I imagine there are other Subsonic compatible iOS apps available.
Does the icon look like a yellow play button with yellow diagonal lines across the background?
It does not. It looks kind of like a T, but it's made out of like an audio waveform.
Okay, it's not that then. Okay, moving on. I won't install that random application with the same name then.
But yes, so I have that on my phone and it literally couldn't work any better. It just works and it picks up my playlists. It plays my songs. It remembers where I was. It does everything that I'd want from a streaming service, but I host it myself.
Excellent.
You have one of those modern Fandangle cars that has Android Auto, do you not?
I do.
Do you ever use Android Auto? And then the further follow-up part two, does this application work with Android Auto?
Yes and no. So I do also have another app which I have just my car playlist on, which is a commercial app called Musicalette, which is absolutely fantastic as a media player, but it's not Subsonic compatible and it's not open source. It is a commercial app that I pay for because it's good and has good Android Auto support. The thing that it doesn't do on Android Auto, which I really wish it did, is you cannot tell it to play a playlist using the voice control. You can tell it to play anything in your library, but you can't tell it to play a playlist. So I tell it to play car music and it plays a song by someone with car in their name.
Oh dear.
Yeah. And then stops because they've only got one song. I mean, I've only got one of their songs. So that is another app I would recommend, but it doesn't support Subsonic. I would like to find an app that does support Subsonic and Android Auto. So if anyone knows of one, please let me know.
My challenge is similar in that I also would like to get off Spotify and have all my music on my server, and I would like to have all this stuff, but I've made it increasingly harder for myself because, yes, I use an iPhone and I like using CarPlay and I have two children and I have a family plan on Spotify. So, yes, the struggle is real.
You have well and truly locked yourself in there, my friend.
I have.